Yeah, you just turn it on.
There you go.
Okay,
there you go.
One, two, three.
Nice.
Yep. All right, everyone. This is Martin Chang. He will be speaking about, you lost your mic, building new GML backends for novel accelerators, how, challenge, and opportunities. You ready to go?
Yeah.
All right, take it away, Martin.
All right. Sorry for the crazy setup, but hopefully everything is clear by now. So let's talk building about new GGML backends. A lot of hardware companies is starting to come up with the new and different hardwares that have supposedly to be vastly, vastly faster than GPUs. Most of them have come with their own programming difficulties and mismatches. So for example, the hardware may not support a certain feature that is very common on GPUs or CPUs, and you just have to somehow deal with that. Yep, and this talk is about the how to integrate that differences into GGML, the challenges or the program mismatches that you expect that you'll have to see, and the opportunities or things that we still have to do. There's a lot to go through in 20 minutes, so I'll try my best, but no guarantees that I will be able to do everything. But first of all, some disclosure. I'm currently technically sponsored by TensorRent, but this work is going to happen with or without their support. I'm very grateful for their support, and the engineering is very, very helpful. And about 2 minutes ago, they just told me if anyone is interested in their hardware, find them outside the door, and they will be able to help you gain access to their hardware. Very good open source policy. First, some background on myself. Who am I? I do a lot of C++ and HPC. I'm a Fox developer, obviously. And this is my version of fun. This is a lot of stuff I do besides doing AI. I maintain web frameworks, maintain a niche search engine for a niche internet protocol. And I also develop system libraries for security. Beyond that, let's get back to the original topic, GGML. Hopefully everyone knows what it is. It's the backend of Llama CPP, which is what a lot of people use right now. It's very efficient for inference, and especially for large language models. It has very strong quantization support. It has a very good community and very flexible. And most importantly for us, it's written in C or C++, which makes developing very, very easy to integrate that into a new hardware and a new input new capabilities of the hardware. Quickly go through my journey. I started about 2022 where there's a new chip called the RQ5A. There's an AI core processor on there. I really wanted a local AI system without trying a 3090 running in the summer in Taiwan, which could be like 40 degrees Celsius, which is, I don't need another space heater for me. Either way, that sort of work, I'm able to integrate the coprocessor support into Llama CPP, but due to the architecture, it doesn't really work out. So I decided to pivot, and at the time TensorRent started to sell their first dev kits, I got this thinking, well, what's the worst could happen? And that's how I got started on this project. So the last talk, people talked about, TensorRent in detail, like how their hardware works. But in case there's other people, this is the very gist version of it. It's a many-core processor, so it has a lot of RISC-V's organized into different grids. These RISC-V's are connected to different core processors, so you can do computation and tensor operations really efficiently. They call these RISC-V cores baby because they are really, really small. And by small, I mean like undergrad textbook level of small. It's a grid of cores. It's a network on chip, so cores can talk to other cores. There's no global cache or unified memory, so each core has access to its own memory, and you can ask a DRAM to send some data to you or send data somewhere else. There's no cache. It's explicit, they have flow management, which will come into a little bit of effect later on. And and it also scales to a very large array by just sticking more chips together and communicating with each other using one of the peripherals. I stole a slide from their hot chip slide stack for their next generation processor. As you can see, it's a grid of CPUs and different CPUs for different purposes. There's the different core types. There's DRAM, there's Ethernet, and they call it Tensix, or just the compute. Compute just does compute. It does the AI math that we actually care about. The DRAM cores is interesting. The compute core can either just request DMA and ask the DRAM to send data from the DRAM into its local address and do compute there, or a DRAM core can actively push data from DRAM into other cores, so when they need it, it's there. There's also the Ethernet core, which does only communication, and that's how it scales beyond one chip natively and don't need some crazy peripheral for that kind of work. Inside the compute core, there's really five RISC-V cores that's working together. There's two RISC-Vs that's connected to the NOC router. These NOC routers are able to talk to the other cores and most importantly, DRAM, so it can access data. And only these two cores can programmatically. For the compute, there's three cores that's working together to perform computation. The compute side is really a tensor engine and a vector engine working together. Unlike traditional like multi-core multiprocessor architecture, each RISC-V cores there are working together to control the peripherals instead of being the main system that's doing the computation. Yep. Because of this architecture, everything has to be explicitly managed, including data flow. So instead of just the compute core saying, "Hey, I want DRAM data from this DRAM address and be able to fetch it," what has to happen is one of the cores connected to the NOC has to request memory from the DRAM. The DRAM has to send the data to its local memory. These compute cores can then take that data, do the computation, and put it back into its local memory. And then NOC connected core can then take that data and output that to the memory. That's how it's supposed to work. And the Ethernet core is able to scale up, to communicate with other chips and be scaling out the architecture. This is the current SDK stack. There's on the bottom, there's Metallium, which is a C++ OpenCL-like API, so you can directly program on the device. On top, they build TTNN, which is their tensor and operator library. It's also a tensor library, unlike CUDNN, which NVIDIA provides, because they need something called Tile, which we'll touch on later, but it's for hardware efficiency. On top, they have the MLR, their own MLR stack and their own VLM fork. All of these software here are open source, so it's very hackable. In my development progress, I also contributed a lot of features back into the software stack. And of course, this talk is about the Llama CPP and GGML support, so that's that. And that's the current community software. Let's take a look at what the accelerators is expecting. So unlike GPUs, where you can just directly program them to do an array or something operation, these devices usually gives you some sort of higher level access. So for example, in this code, like we just open one device, we create a tensor, we tileize it. This is a special operation just to make the hardware more efficient. We can do level one cache, which does not exist on their hardware. You can store tensors here. It's really high bandwidth because it's directly on chip, but it's small. It's only 100 megabytes compared to their 12 gigabytes of DRAM. Okay, that's the gist of the processor, and we can start building the GGML backend. So this is the general flow. You have to register your backend, scan for supported ops, so tell GGML what you can support, what you don't. You have to accept tensors from GGML, upload that to device, execute all the operations, and GGML can, after you do all the math, send the result back to GGML. But here's the problem that developers have to somehow fix. GGML expected role major tensors, but TTN has to use tile tensors for hardware efficiency. Metallium doesn't support device memory mapping, while GGML, because how GPU works, they expect the CPU can directly access the device memory. And GGML also does byte allocation, which doesn't really work on tensoring device because allocations are typed. So what do I mean by that? That means when I create a 4 gigabyte buffer, for example, I have to tell the device that it is holding a 32-bit floating point or 16-bit floating point. These information are missing from GGML and has to be somewhat has to be dealt with. There's also different quantization types, which is different to GGML and somehow. Yep. And so first of all, we have to register device with let's register backend with GGML. So GGML has something called the GGML backend registry, which is just a big list of different backends. You can see there's the CUDA backend, Metal, SQL, Vulkan, et cetera, et cetera. This is a very big list with a lot of if defs. So what you have to do is just end up add your own device backend here and register it with GGML. Afterwards, it calls your device registration function. Here you have to return a backend handle, a backend registry. And each registry has a registry interface. This interface is a giant big vtable that has some required and some optional functions that you have to implement yourself, and also a context that tells your backend that what itself working on. Otherwise, the backend doesn't know what kind of data it has or what devices it has. So talking about the interface, so the interface, like I said, is a giant vtable that GGML uses this pattern internally very, very, very much. And some of these interfaces functions can return more vtables or more interfaces. So for example, this one, the get device, will return a device interface. There's a whole lot of interface like these in GGML for device, memory pools, buffer management, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long list and I don't have time to get into. So I have to populate all the interfaces and eventually you figured out most of the interface and stuff will start working. And after you get that working, you have tensor pool management, but it gets around the problem so you won't crash. And all the operators has to read data from metadata to know the actual tensor instead of using the map address. Right. Okay, you can allocate tensors. You have to get data in and out. Here's the problem. Not all tensoring processors support all the GGML types. Just take the quantized data. The format is different. And tensoring processors, their RISC-V cores are very small, very slow. They are not designed to do actual compute. They are more controllers. So you cannot expect the CPU cores there to do all the dequantization like we do on the GPU. So instead, since we already deferred the actual allocation, what we had to do is dequantize into FP32 or FP16, upload that to a device, tileize it, and then cast manually to whatever type tensor and hardware actually supports on device and be close it. The same thing for get tensor, which is the reverse operation. And then what you do is, after you are able to do tensor upload and download, next thing you do is tell GGML what operation you actually support. This is a toy version that just tells GGML, hey, I support a 32-bit floating point tensors. The open operator none is a special case that tells GGML, GGML tells you this tensor holds actual data instead of this is an operation. And in this code, we also tell GGML, hey, we support add operation if the dimension is one. Then GGML will do back operation scheduling and figure out like who runs what. And then you're responsible to, GGML will give you an array of data, of nodes to run, and just run it in iteratively one by one. One problem you have to deal with is views. Views are operations that create reads from the data tensor, but that doesn't do edge computation like that. So things like resize views and transpose, which views heavily depend on the fact that tensor data are stored in row major layout, which is not the case again. So initially, the solution was to just eagerly evaluate it. We see a view, we execute it. The problem with this approach is GGML would attempt to write data back into tensor buffers, which if you eagerly evaluate it, it's already realized you can write data back to original tensor. So the real solution is you have to do a lazy evaluation and see, hey, GGML is writing. You have to do the right, correct thing to write into original buffer instead of writing to a copy, which doesn't work. So that's a gist of getting backends working within GGML. In the development process, we figured out that there's a lot of missing features that in GGML that is very helpful for ASICs, but is not necessarily as helpful for GPUs. First thing is graph rewrites. GGML doesn't really have it. So like I said before, TensorRent devices, they support storing data on SRAM. So, but let me out.
Give me a round of applause. Like the other speakers, I'm going to kick Martin out for over there. So if you want to find him afterwards, you can ask him some questions there. Next, Gianluca will be speaking here in just a moment. Give about 2 minutes, and we'll start the next talk.